KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. What can Lego teach us about innovation? It turns out the company has a lot more to offer than plastic bricks. We're going to hear about it later this hour. Also, our panel of gardeners will be in later in the hour to answer your gardening questions. A new study by the Economic Policy Institute says that a family of four, two parents, two kids in Seattle, needs at least $70,000 a year to maintain what they call a modest lifestyle. John Burbank joins us now. He's executive director of the Economic Opportunity Institute, which is a regional partner of the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
The EPI talks about what it costs to maintain a modest lifestyle. Can you explain what that means, a modest lifestyle?
Well, I would say it's below the average lifestyle. For example, in their calculations for a modest lifestyle, they're calculating rent at the 40th percentile, meaning that it's for that 40th percentile means that 60% of all rent is higher than that. They're calculating food costs using the low-cost plan from the Department of Agriculture, which assumes that almost all food is bought at the grocer and then prepared at home. That is not much money to go out. They're calculating the cost of operating a car for work, and then they're calculating the cost of health care, including insurance premiums and out-of-pocket expenditures, and also child care. And so if you take these all those factors into consideration, that's how you come up with their calculations for what I would consider a modest budget for a family of two parents and two children.
How is this different, or I guess how much higher is this than the federal poverty level?
It is approximately $25,000 higher, so probably about 33 or 40% higher than the federal poverty level. Keep in mind that the Economic Policy Institute is not interested in developing economies in which the majority of people are in poverty. We actually are much more interested in making sure that people have a good quality of life and a certain form of economic security and educational opportunity. And also the problem, a lot of the problems with the poverty index is that it was developed in the early 1960s. And really has not been updated since that time, except for inflation. And obviously, there's been a lot of changes in the economy and in purchasing since that time.
Now, this modest lifestyle, we're not talking middle class. We're still talking about something that would be below what somebody considers to be middle class, right?
Well, unfortunately, yes and no. That it is because of the undermining of the middle class and the stagnation of wages over the past 5 years, actually over the past 10 years, what was perhaps a slightly more comfortable middle class existence is now not as comfortable. So we're, you know, our for example, our median household income in King County is about $65,000 a year, and that means that that would be considered middle class, and yet this modest income for a family of two parents and two children of $70,000 is above that. Let me just give you an example of how this could work, or how this does work, unfortunately. One of my colleagues has a modest home, 960 square feet. His mortgage is $2,200 a month. He has one child. They're not going to have another child. And their child care payments are $1,600 a month. So that amounts right there to about $45,000 a year that's going just to housing and to child care for a modest family. He has one car that's 12 years old. And so, you know, he's not living high off the hog in this with this income.
So essentially what you're saying is $70,000 at some time sounded like a lot of money, but what we're talking about now for a family of four, two parents, two kids, is that it would afford you in Seattle to sort of just barely be able to be comfortable.
Yes, I would say that is unfortunately very accurate. And then if you consider that obviously parents want their children to go to college and the tuition at the University of Washington is now about $12,500. So, it's almost 25% of the median household income right now. So that is another factor. And unfortunately, if you're at $70,000 or $75,000, you're not going to get something like the state need grant for your kids. So this is a real squeeze on the middle class, and that's why this number of 70,000 is actually quite modest, and why we need to think about how we can actually increase the minimum wage, and that will help to push up other wage levels. If the minimum wage had kept up with productivity, the federal minimum wage was at its highest in 1968, and if it had kept up in productivity, it would be at about $21.75 today. Unfortunately, the gains in productivity have not gone to low-wage workers. Rather, they tend to have gone to the very top echelon of corporate leaders and to corporate profits themselves.
So is that the intent of the findings from the Economic Policy Institute, to use them to leverage an increase in the minimum wage?
Well, I think the intent is to show that we need to be conscious of how to develop a high road economic strategy in which we are creating jobs that are ladders for economic security and educational opportunity. So rather than promoting a low wage strategy, it's important that we look at ways of actually having wages keep up with productivity, the productivity of the workers themselves, and therefore enable them to enjoy some of the fruits of their own labor.
How confident are you that that's going to happen?
Well, 2 years ago, no one really thought that the Seattle would pass a paid sick days ordinance. And yet in September of 2011, the mayor signed a paid sick day ordinance that created paid sick days, the right to paid sick days, a new workplace standard for 140,000 workers who previously didn't have it in the private sector. So I think that these are possible if we find the political will, the allies, the business allies to promote this a livable wage for workers within Seattle.
John Burbank is the executive director of the Economic Opportunity Institute. It's a regional partner of the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Economic Policy Institute recently issued a new family budget calculator. That calculator shows that an average Seattle family of two parents and two kids needs an annual income of just over $70,000 to maintain what's called a modest lifestyle. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Ten fifteen. What Lego can teach us about succeeding in business in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor organic garden supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, organic earthworm castings, and sunshine mix, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
70 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 83 this afternoon with lots of sun. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high of 75. And it's going to be partly to mostly sunny all the way through the weekend. So we're continuing our pattern of sunny, dry days. What does that mean for your garden? Our expert gardening panel joins us in 25 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Lego, I don't have to say more than that one word, and you already have a clear picture in your mind. The little plastic snap-together bricks, they come in red, yellow, blue, white, and black. At least those are the colors that we have in my house. Lego is so omnipresent in our culture, the very name has come to mean plastic brick in the same way that Kleenex denotes a paper tissue. You would think that Lego, so omnipresent, really so beloved, was immune to the vagaries of the toy market and the economy, but you would be wrong. David C. Robertson's a professor of innovation and practice at the Wharton Business School. He chronicles the story of Lego's near collapse and its reinvention in his new book called Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry. Welcome to our studios.
Thanks for having me.
I want to take us back to Lego. The bricks themselves came about in the 1950s, but the company, the family-owned company in Denmark, precedes the little bricks by many decades, doesn't it?
That's right. It was started in 1932 by a carpenter named Ole Kirk Christensen, who got into toys because he couldn't find enough wood for furniture. I mean, it was between the two world wars. It was a depression. And so he just started making toys out of scraps of wood.
And was the company pretty successful, or was it just still a little tiny thing at that point?
It was. It was a fairly small company, even through not just Ole Kirk, but his son, Godfred, all the way up until the late 70s.
So that we're in the third generation of the of this family at that point.
We're actually going from the third to the fourth generation now. It's still mostly family owned, yes.
So as you write about it, the brick itself was many years in development. It was the son of the founder who had this idea, you know, plastics. I'm thinking, you know, the movie with Dustin Hoffman, that The Graduate, with the one word plastics. But for some reason, plastics was the word that was going to really transform this company.
Yeah, they the founder, Ole Kirk Christensen, in 1947 invested 2 years' worth of profits in an injection molding machine.
2 years of profits in one machine.
In one machine, and his sons were against it. And the early experiments, as I understand it, were not that successful. The toy stores returned them, saying that kids will never play with plastic toys, that they'll want those good old-fashioned wooden toys.
So what led to that moment where all of a sudden the plastic brick was more than just somebody's sort of pipe dream and something that was not only real but profoundly beloved?
Well, it was a couple of things. I mean, they perfected the knob and tube thing that makes it snap together just right. They call it clutch power, that, you know, kids can put it together and it stays together,
right.
But it's not so strong that they can't pull it apart. But there was a conversation on a ferry one day between the son of the founder, Godfred Christensen, and a department store head. And the department store head was saying, look, what we need is not another toy. What we need is a system of play, mm-hmm. something where if you buy multiple toys, then that doesn't add to your enjoyment of it. It multiplies it. You can do a lot more with it. And he looked around and he looked at all the different toys he was selling, and he found that really only the brick promised that. And over the next couple of years, he got rid of 90% of his toys and just focused on the brick, which is a pretty gutsy move when you think about it.
The other thing that was striking in your account of these years, and these are sort of the 50s, 60s years, was that this is a company that's not even located in Copenhagen. It's in, I'm not even sure where it is in Denmark. I haven't been Billund, Denmark, which sounds like it's sort of off the beaten track and in somebody's, you know, they have a nice headquarters and they're just sort of there doing their thing.
There's 3 hours of nothing in every direction.
Oh, really? So it really is off the beaten
right,
track.
Right. The people in Copenhagen think of Billund as out of touch with, you know, with Denmark.
So here's this what I think of as this like ubiquitous brand name that's happening out of the spotlight and sort of out of the sort of conversation about what's new, what's hip, what's happening. They're just sort of following a path. The other thing that struck me about them is that they had sort of a company motto or a mission statement, if you will, that was very clear about what they wanted to do with their product. And it's about creativity.
Lego is formed from two words, Lego, which is play well. And later they found out that it kind of roughly translated from Latin means I put together.
Really?
Yeah. But they also have another statement, Det beste ist ikke für gut. I think I'm probably
wow.
mangling that.
Wow.
But it means basically it's kind of like the best is only good enough, or only the best is good enough. I think the Danish are a little more dour than that. It's the best is only good enough, and that's Lego's motto, that they really believe in that quality.
So it's really not like good enough for us to make profits. That wasn't the motto. Is like we're just going to be only good enough, but we're going to strive for something that's of a particular quality threshold.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And the story behind that is that the son of the founder, Godfred, was making some ducks, some wooden ducks, and he put on two coats of varnish instead of the required three, and he took them to the train station to be shipped out the next morning. And he came back and he told his father about how he'd saved so much time by only putting two coats of varnish on. And his father made him go back, get the ducks, and stay up all night and put the third coat of varnish on. And Godfred, the son, later put that, carved that in a piece of wood, that saying, of the best is only good enough.
So here we have this company. It's got a sense of pride, a sense of history, a product that it believes in. And obviously, I grew up knowing about Lego. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. My son grew up playing with Lego. And the company was going along just fine. And then its patent expired.
That was part of it, yeah. So the patent was taken out in 1958, and it expired. They tried to argue that it was a trademark, that the shape of the brick was in fact a trademark. That failed everywhere. And so anybody could make a Lego brick, and a lot of companies started doing that.
How did that impact the finances of Lego?
Not for a while. Lego did really well. From when the grandson of the founder took over, a guy named Kjellkirk Christensen in 1978, he did a couple of amazing innovations, I think. He really put some effort behind Duplo, the bigger bricks for smaller hands, so mm-hmm. that younger kids, toddlers, would play with Lego. And he put some effort behind Technique, the more complicated Lego with beams and gears and motors, and so that older kids would play with Lego.
But still, there was that idea of the system. It was a continuum. Product, right?
Yeah. But the big thing that I think he did was the minifigure. So you and I, when we played with Lego as a kid, we didn't have the minifigure.
No.
People 40 and below do have the minifigure. And what happens is he rescaled all the toy sets around it. Before, one of the most popular sets in the mid-70s was a family set where the granny and the father stood, I think it's 9 or 10 bricks tall.
Huh.
That was almost as tall as the train set, but wouldn't fit in the train set. And it towered over the house set, you know, like some 50s monster movie. That, when they came with the minifigure, they scaled all the sets around it. So they took that whole idea of a system of play and they expanded it around the minifigure so that if your kids are playing with Harry Potter and Hermione Granger gets in trouble, then Obi-Wan Kenobi or Batman can come save them, right, from the other sets.
So everybody's interactive. It's one big universe as far as your imagination can go.
That's right, yeah.
We're talking with David Robertson, and his book is called Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry. Well, so at this point, they really had conquered the global toy industry. They were riding high.
They were, yeah, and that all went up from 1978 to 1993. They grew at 14% per year for 15 years. They're doubling in size every 5 years for 15 years.
That's pretty astonishing.
Yeah.
But then everything fell in.
Yeah, well, it kind of tailed off. So about 5 years in the middle of the 90s where sales were flat, but they kept pumping out more and more toys. And so, you know, the costs went up, but the sales didn't. Mm. So the profits went down. They had a big loss in 98. They laid off 1,000 people. The grandson of the founder, he now says, I've been doing this for 20 years. Maybe I'm not the right guy to lead it to the next generation. He brings in a turnaround expert, a guy named Paul Plowman, who just turned around Bang & Olufsen, and then they just start innovating. What they did first was they went out and they looked at the market and they found that, number one, a lot of kids are getting older, younger, and dropping traditional toys, mm-hmm. like not just Lego, but Barbie and Hot Wheels. They're going to video games like Nintendo and back then the PlayStation 2. The distribution channel, like Toys R Us and Walmart, has gotten much more sophisticated. And they know more about why kids are buying Lego and what they're buying than Lego does. And, of course, like we talked about, the patents have expired so anybody can make a Lego. But also everybody else has moved their production to China. And so all the other toys you could buy for your kids have gotten cheaper, whereas Lego is still made in Denmark. the Danish kroner appreciates against the dollar, so Lego gets more expensive. And so they realized there, my strategy colleagues at Wharton would say, this is a recipe for disaster. This is about the worst market you could be in, a commodity product in a vicious global industry. You know, they had to do something.
And they did, and they followed, there's sort of seven guidelines. I'm not sure who came up with these innovation guidelines, but, you know, one of your colleagues, no doubt, you know, business experts, you know, go to new markets, you know, go where no man has gone before. You inspire me when you talk about Spock. And they followed these seven guidelines that were essentially sort of the bedrock of innovation at the time that these turnaround experts were at work, right?
Yeah, and we still teach them at Wharton. I was at McKinsey for 5 years, and we used to preach them there, and we're still doing it. So they are the kind of truths about innovation. And in some cases, the books hadn't even been published yet. But if you look at what Lego did, you could argue that Lego tried to do each one of these methods for boosting innovation and between 99 and 2002.
And before we talk about how that worked out, what they did was they listened to, you know, these kids are getting older, younger, there's technology competing. They went for design. They went for ideas. They had people, it sounds like, you know, an idea a minute was popping out of these people. Everybody was energized.
Yeah. I mean, they acquired a company called Zowie Entertainment that made intelligent toys in California. They opened up a design studio in Milan, Italy. They tried all kinds of toy experiments. They were really, you know, remember, this was 1999, and digital and virtual was everything. There was a strong group in the company that was arguing that the brick was passé, and that it was, they really needed to think outside of the box and come up with, you know, really new play experiences for the new generation of kids. And they did.
And how'd that work out for them?
It all worked until it didn't. There was a couple of big hits. One was Bionicle. Mm-hmm. I don't know if your kids played with
it. I have a whole cupboard full of them, yes.
I was a significant investor in Bionicle also. My son just loved it. My daughter did too, even though it's kind of more a boy toy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember listening to my kids play one day, and they're in the basement. I think my son was 7 and my daughter was 4.5. And my son said, okay, now I'll take this Bionicle and you take that Bionicle, and we're going to have a battle, and we're going to try and capture. And my daughter said, well, and after we're going to sing and dance and get married and live happily ever after. Anyhow, Bionicle was huge.
Yes.
Lego Star Wars was started in 1999. That did really well in 1999 because there was a Star Wars movie, but then sales fell off. They picked up again in 2002 when there was another Star Wars movie. The third popular toy was Lego Harry Potter.
Right.
And that was really popular in 2001 and 2002 when there were Harry Potter movies. There's no Star Wars or Harry Potter movie in 2003 or the first half of 2004. Sales of those two of the three really profitable toys fall off a cliff, and Lego is left with a lot of creative but unprofitable and kind of un-Lego-y toys that they developed.
The other thing they did was get rid of Duplo.
They did. They got rid of this wonderful brand. I was told that Germans actually liked Duplo more than Lego. It was a bigger brand in Germany. And they, again, thought the brick was passé, so they replaced it with a brand called Explore, which had some electronic toys for toddlers.
And with these sort of hit-and-miss decisions that they'd made, the company ended up bleeding kroner, I guess. This Danish kroner was the currency. But like millions of dollars they were losing a day, it sounded like.
Yeah. There was a meeting in June of 2003 where a young analyst named Jørgen V. Nudstorp, he came in and was asked to look at the situation. And he came in front of the management board and said, we're going to lose 1 billion Danish kroner. That's about 10% of their sales in 2003 and probably twice as much in 2004. We're running out of cash. We have no committed lines of credit. We're about to default on our loans. We may not make it. And in fact, he and the CFO that was appointed soon after went out to Mattel to explore, you know, whether they could sell the company to Mattel. They were really close to bankruptcy in 2003.
And this is a really, I don't have any percentages, but pretty much most Northern European households and most American households had some kind of Lego presents if they could afford it. I mean, this is a toy that literally was everywhere.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, isn't it, to think about that? But they were so focused on thinking outside the box and coming up with these big new innovations that they forgot that there was lots of money in the box, that there is actually a role for the brick, and that, you know, parents like the brick, kids like the brick, and that, in fact, one of the things they learned from all those experiments is that if kids play with virtual bricks, they want more physical bricks, not less. Hmm. That there's nothing disruptive about it, to use one of the words from the business press.
So they got rid of the innovation team, and they ignored those seven established rules of innovation.
I would argue that they actually do them better than ever. That they what happened was not that those rules of innovation didn't work. The problem was that they did, and they accelerated innovation beyond what Lego could control. And what I think Lego's learned is that if you're going to boost innovation, then what you have to do is also boost the kind of discipline and control, the focus of that innovation. And that's what happened. It got away from them. If you were a designer in Lego in 2001, you were brought in and you were told to create something great, a great play experience. Now, if you're brought in, you're told to create a great police station. And by the way, you can't use any shape piece you want. You can't make up some new shape. You have to use a very limited palette of pieces and colors that are used in lots of other sets, and so produced in much higher volume, and so cost much less. And so the toys are profitable. The toys are more Lego-y because you have to use those pieces that can be reused in lots of different ways. And the company has done tremendously well. Sales have grown at 24% per year every year for the past 5 years, and profits at 40% per year.
Through the recession.
Through the recession. The recession affected Mattel and Hasbro tremendously, but not Lego.
What struck me were three sort of concepts. I was going to say words, but they're not really words, that help get this company on track in addition to sort of rethinking those seven principles of innovation. One was the idea of core mission. One was the idea of authenticity. And the other was user loyalty. Mm. And it seems like in reinventing itself out of this horrible mess, that they went back to what old Kirk did initially, which was to think about, you know, what do I want? What is a quality level? What is our mission?
Yeah, they did. They really did. And who are we making toys for? You know, it's not for anybody. It is for one of the mistakes they made in 2001 and 2002 is they started trying to make toys for all kids. And what they realized is that there's some kids that just don't like building stuff. And so we should make toys for kids that like the construction experience. And when they went back to do that, people came back to the brand. That a lot of parents, I mean, I've been guilty of this, and maybe you have too, where it's that rainy Sunday afternoon, the kids are driving you nuts, you go get a Lego just to get a couple hours of quiet. Well, if you bought a Jack Stone or a Galador toy in 2002, that gave you about 10 minutes of quiet, and you ended up disappointed with the brand and maybe moving to Kinex or something else.
So beyond Lego, this is a fascinating story of this company which has managed to put itself back on track. What lessons do you as a business professor teach for folks who are at Mattel or any other company?
Yeah, well, I think it applies to lots of other companies. I've taught this case in a lot of different executive education classrooms and worked with a lot of companies. And, I did this book as a 320-page case study because I wanted to talk about innovation governance. This is something that as soon as you say the G word, executives' eyes glaze over and they think about bureaucracy and whatever. But it's tremendously important if you're going to develop not just a product innovation, but some kind of service and channel to market and customer experience and pricing plan and business process and some set of complementary innovations that all go together. You're going to be involving people from all over the company, from outside partners, and how you set up a system where those people are all working together and funded appropriately and reviewed and coordinated is really what governance is all about. And Lego does that better than anybody I've seen.
It also seems like it would apply to nonprofits as well.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of how you organize, how you involve your staff, how you organize your staff, and how you implement a mission or a vision or a goal.
Yeah, yeah. It is all about how to give teams the space they need to be creative, but the direction they need to deliver. that Lego spent, you know, a lot of money creating unprofitable, un-Lego-y toys. You know, now they're much more focused and much more profitable. And some of the people from 2001 left. They didn't like that constraint. But the ones that remained said, you know, in a way we relearned what Lego was all about. How do you take this limited palette of pieces and turn it into something great? And they say, you know, now, you know, before maybe 1 in 10 toys got into kids' hands. Now, like 9 out of 10 are playing with my fire truck or my police station. And there's a real satisfaction in that. It's different, but it's an important. And also, it's much more profitable. So the company's going to grow and I'm going to have a job in 5 years and so forth.
David Robertson, professor of practice at the Wharton School. He teaches innovation and product development. His new book called Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Global Toy Industry. It's a fascinating read. Thanks for coming in.
Sure. For your listeners, there's lots more at robertsoninnovation.com. That's all one word. You know, tools that companies can use and if you want to try and repeat this in your company. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
Ten 37, gardening advice right around the corner, and the corner is just a minute away.
Hi, this is Melissa Block. In order to keep KUOW and NPR operating properly, we count on support from listeners. Every minute of public radio service every day is made possible by listeners like you. You may have recently received a renewal reminder in the mail. Please mail it back or renew online at kuow.org. And thanks from all of us.
71 degrees in Seattle. We expect to reach 83 this afternoon with lots of sun. Tomorrow, a little bit of clouds in the morning and then partly sunny in the afternoon with a high of 75. 10:38, I'm Bernard Ouellette. The police in New York have been gassing subway stations across New York City to study airflow and prepare for a chemical disaster. We'll have more about that in the news at 11.
It's Tuesday. It's been warm and sunny for the most part, and gardens around my house are in full bloom. Time to welcome back our Green Days gardening paddle. Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel. You can find her at her website, martywingate.com, and lots of books out as well. Laura Matter's been a practicing horticulturalist for more than 30 years. She coordinates Seattle Tilth's garden hotline. Last but certainly not least is Greg Rayburn. He's the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. And welcome back, all three of you. And I do my own personal garden tours, which means I walk around my neighborhood.
And snoop.
And I do snoop and think about whether I can steal poppy seeds out of dried poppy heads, but I haven't done so yet. But Laura, there is an official sort of urban vegetable garden
indeed.
Tour.
Yeah, the Seattle Tilth, it's the urban farm and chicken.
The chicken tour?
Coop tour. So even, I mean, it started as a chicken coop tour, but it's sort of expanded because people have so many other urban livestock and these little mini farms in their yard. So this Saturday, folks will be able to buy tickets to get a map that will send them off to people's private yards to go look at how people manage all this. And it's pretty awesome. I've been, even though I don't really have a yard that's appropriate for chickens, I go sometimes just because it's really fun to see what people are doing.
It seems like in my own private Idaho that I tour around in that there are people that have, you know, pretty small urban lots and they've managed to really stuff a lot in.
It's exactly right. You know, looking at what people do yard to yard, I've been in yards that are literally right next door to each other, completely different in, as to how they manage things. Little tiny skinny chicken coop runs that they manage to get enough space for them to run around and the different breeds of chickens. So, you know, you get a little lesson in that as well.
Our phone number is 543-5869 or email us weekday at kuow.org. Marty, I know I've gone also on sort of the art garden tours and the ornamental garden tours. So I'm assuming that those still exist as well.
Oh my
as
gosh.
Urban farm tours.
There are so many tours every weekend at this time of year. In fact, this Sunday is the Georgetown Garden and Art Walk, which is free. And you can find all of the garden tours listed on the Miller Library's website. That's the place to go because you have all the contact information, dates and times.
So in addition to seeing things, you can steal ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right.
That's
indeed.
The whole idea.
That's the whole idea. If you don't want to steal, if you'd like to call and get an idea, we give them away for free. 543-5869 is our phone number. And Paul in Seattle, you were quick on the dialing, so you are here on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I've been growing raspberries for about 30 years, but this year I'm finding little tiny yellow worms in them. I was wondering if you know what they are.
Mm. Well, I'm hoping they're not the spotted-winged Drosophila. That's coming on strong now. I would look online at different visuals of what those worms look like so you can ID them, because there are other insects that will get into raspberries as well. But the spotted winged Drosophila is actually a fruit fly that likes unripe fruit, which is really unfortunate because it means it's hard for us to actually get to pick it before these guys get into it.
Uh-huh.
So
I thought I'd heard a year or two ago that there was some new winged fly invading from somewhere that was attacking raspberries. But
that,
I can't remember
that is
it.
That is it.
That's
the one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Say that name again, please.
It's spotted winged Drosophila. And Drosophila is the family name for lots of different fruit flies. But the spotted wing one, you'll find lots of information from WSU about that online. You can call the garden hotline, too, directly. We have lots of links to that. We can help you with that.
Is there anything he can do about spotted winged Drosophila?
Well, you can net them with very fine netting once they've started to put fruit on at the very early stages. We're getting kind of past that now.
And that's netting the plants, not the individual
yeah,
flies.
Yeah, well, you can net the flies, too, if you want. Yeah.
But if these little larvae, they're inside his fruit, he can't do anything at
you
that point.
You can't, no.
Can you eat them? I mean, are they edible if they're in your fruit?
Well, they start to spoil the fruit because they tunnel through it and it starts to sort of bruise and rot the fruit inside.
Oh, Paul, I'm so sorry. Thanks for that call. Are you hearing a lot about these?
We do. Actually, we've seen them at our garden at the Good Shepherd Center, and we do put fine netting and we do vinegar traps to see when they're around. We start to find them.
So what's a vinegar trap?
It's a little plastic cup hung up with vinegar in the bottom of it that's attractive to them. So they'll go into that cup and drown.
They like vinegar?
They do. They're attracted to it.
Any particular kind of vinegar?
Nope. Cheap vinegar.
White wine vinegar.
Champagne vinegar, and you're going to get more of those Drosophila, which I thought those are the things that you study in biology class, right?
They are.
That propagate really, really, really fast,
yes,
right?
It's the ones that everybody studies the genetics of.
And every lab has them still flying around as they escape and continue to replicate.
Ooh, okay. Okay. Let's move on. 543-KUOW, 1-800-289-5869. Hi, Eric's in Olympic Hills. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. And I have a question and then a very short follow-up. The question is, I love to plant nasturtiums. They're so bright. They're so wonderful to fill space. But every year, I get the aphid attack. I am wondering whether I can preempt and eliminate the chance, or at least minimize the chance of that, by preemptively spraying them with a soapy water solution. Is there any way that I can discourage aphids from ever getting on my nasturtiums?
The insecticidal soap or whatever recipe you might want to use at home is a contact control. So it has to be sprayed on the actual pest, sadly. I resent the fact that people use nasturtiums as a trap crop because I love them too, and I don't want to trap the aphids to keep them off the beans. I want the nasturtiums looking good. It's easy on some plants to control aphids because you can use a hard spray of water every few days and pretty much knock them off. But nasturtiums are delicate, and you can't turn over every single leaf.
No.
And in other words, I'm saying no.
Oh, no. So no preventive plan of attack. But what do you do with nasturtiums? My husband just planted a bunch of them, and I kind of cringe because I think they're gorgeous and they taste really good in a salad. But they are like a magnet for aphids.
They are. You can turn every single leaf over and spray insecticidal soap on them.
Or squish them by hand.
Well, then you squish the leaves because they're so delicate.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, just enjoy them while you can, Eric. Is that it? Is that your advice?
Yeah.
Keep planting them.
Yes, that's right. succession nasturtiums. Yeah.
Succession crops of nasturtium. Thanks for your call, Eric. We have our gardening panel here, Marty Wingett, Laura Matter, and Greg Rayburn. Mike writes, it looks like what I thought would be a crop of about 100 carrots will decrease to zero very soon. I figured it was squirrels and sprinkled cayenne pepper around the patch. It didn't work. Am I right that the culprits will likely be squirrels? Any way to keep them out in the future? Oh, the patch is near an apple tree. Last year, a few apples on the young tree had been nibbled on, unbeknownst to me till too late. If the culprit is again a squirrel, is there a way to keep them out of both the apples and the carrots?
Oh boy!
Could be a raccoon.
It's hard to say. Yeah. There's not a description of what they're seeing. Like, are they being pulled out?
Yeah. Or eaten from underground?
Yeah.
Carrots are pretty easy though, because you can do a barrier, a wire hardware cloth barrier
across the top of the patch.
And that's some people that have a real challenges with different nuisance wildlife. They will actually cage in. Especially if you have a raised bed, you can just extend the frame up and have a small enough diameter mesh wire that still allows light in. And
so is there a way for Mike to know if it's a squirrel or some other pest that's eating these things, short of seeing them caught in the act?
Seeing them is usually really what you need to do.
And that's what's really great now are there's all those, you can get those critter cams that are they're relatively inexpensive now. They came from, people used them for scouting for hunting, but they have infrared light on them and you just mount them out there and they're motion activated. So if something crawls in through there, you get a picture of the critter.
Which, of course, reminds me to say everyone needs to rent Wallace and Gromit Curse of the Were-Rabbit because that's what they use in there to trap the pests.
That's true. I have seen that. Judy, in Seattle, you have a solution for aphids on nasturtiums?
I do.
All right. What is it?
It is. Hold on. I've got you on speakerphone there. Okay. It's. I heard about it several years ago and I started doing it. You put your morning bananas peels under the nasturtiums.
And
just take a peel of a banana, one of those strips, and turn it sort of upside down so the white part faces upward, and stick it on the ground right under the plant. And for some reason, they hate those odors, those ester odors or whatever it's in.
Really?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So the aphid doesn't go onto the banana. It avoids the thing altogether?
It avoids the thing altogether.
Well, we are all going out and buying a bunch of bananas today, let me tell you.
Thank you so much. That's amazing. Thanks
It really does work.
Well, wow. Thanks, Judy, for your call. All right. You all learned something?
Yes.
Gardening panel. And bananas safe.
That's
easy.
Right. So we all need to try it and then come back and report.
Okay. And listeners, if you've got nasturtiums and aphids, you try. I assume it would work. I had problems with broccoli and aphids, another crop that it seemed to just attract like a magnet. So maybe you could try it with that as well.
Good. Yeah. Those are the black bean aphids that like all those crops. And they're out there right now. The other aphids are kind of dwindling away. The little green peach aphid and those guys.
They're kind of spring aphids.
Yeah.
They
like cooler weather. But these black bean aphids like the heat of the sun.
So I guess the question is, if we put banana peels under the nasturtiums that already have aphids on them, will the aphids go away?
I don't know. Let's try.
Okay. Banana peels. What is your question, listener? You can call us at 206-543-586-9543-KUOW. Christy in Kenmore. Hi.
Hi there.
You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah. My question is about a dogwood that I have with the really pretty dark purple flowers, and it's got some kind of withering thing where the branches slowly, the leaves wither and start to go black. And I've been cutting off the affected branches because the rest of the tree looks fabulous, and I can't figure out what to do about it or what it might be.
Well, the pink flowering dogwood, or, you know, sometimes they're dark pink or light pink, is highly susceptible to a disease called anthracnose. And so is our native dogwood, as a matter of fact. And so I'm not sure is there a organic control
really,
for that?
No.
I didn't think so. You can be very careful about cleaning up under the tree, picking up all the leaves and dead flowers and pruning off the branches that are affected. You could see if that works, and otherwise you might want to consider planting a different kind of dogwood that is disease resistant. The Cornus cusa, the Korean dogwood, is highly resistant to anthracnose. And there is a pink flowering, at least one pink flowering cultivar. There's one called Satomi.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that one. Good luck with that. Thanks so much for your call, Christy. We're talking to our Green Days gardening panel, as we do each Tuesday morning. And we go now to Bruce in Des Moines. Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Okay. Yeah, my question is, I have a red Japanese maple that's has been in a pot close to the entry, which is entry porch, which is covered. And the one branch is reaching way out, and I would like to transplant it in the fall or early winter or something. And what do I need to do when it's rooted through the pot like that?
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, you'll have to cut off the root that goes through the pot. Generally, that's not trees generally handle root pruning pretty readily. But you will want to wait until the nice, cool, rainy season to do so.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking ahead, but I'd like to be able to move it so it does better.
Yeah, lots of times people are really reluctant to cut into the roots when they take a root-bound plant out of a pot, and then they end up planting it and with this terribly shaped and compacted root system that doesn't do it. You know, it just kind of keeps on spinning around itself rather than really spreading out. So, you should be fine just to remove the roots that are coming out the potholes and straightening out the roots when you put it in the planting hole.
Okay.
Thanks for your call, Bruce. We're talking to our Green Days gardening panel, Greg Rayburn, Laura Matter, Marty Wingett, and we'd love to hear from you as well. Our toll-free number is 800-289-5888. Dan in Kirkland, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have some raspberries. I got them from a friend, transplanted them. They're growing great. They bloom great. I see some bees around, when they're flowering. But for several years now, they never have produced well. They have lots of berries, but I'm not sure what you call them, the individual little bumps on one berry. There's only like 3 or 4 or 5 instead of, a full set on most of the berries.
Sounds like inconsistent pollination, because each one of those represents a little pistil that needs to be pollinated. And it so even though you're seeing lots of bees, I don't know, are they in full sun?
Some bees. I mean, I don't know what lots would be, but I see all those bees there.
Yeah.
I've heard it might have been pollination. I've heard of I can't remember the name now, mason bees were recommended to me.
Yeah, mason bees are great. They come out early in the year, and people with fruit trees really like them. But, just including more flowers in your garden will help draw pollinating insects in. Just in pots, any kind of early and mid-season spring, late spring flowering plants, and a nice variety of them, so you get all kinds of pollinating insects.
Hmm, okay. Can I ask another question?
A quick one.
Okay. I have got zucchini with white things, on, like mold or something, on the leaves. And I've heard that treating it with 10% solution of milk sprayed on it is effective. I've tried that. It seems to be helping. How often do I need to do that, or do you have other solutions?
Well, that is one solution. I don't use milk personally because it starts to smell a little bit, but I've heard people have good luck with that. Baking soda can help too. Basically, what you're doing is changing the pH on the surface of the leaf, which makes it inhospitable for that to grow. And what you're seeing there is called powdery mildew. Generally, we tell people not to worry too much about it, but this year I knew it was coming early because of our hot, humid weather, and that people probably should do a little treatment to keep their plants healthy. So I think you're doing the right thing, and just once a week is probably often enough.
Thanks for your call. We are got a few more minutes here, and I want to squeeze in at least one more call. John and Roy, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
First off, nasturtiums, I love them. They make great hanging baskets. But my question is, I've got a terrible problem with tansy, and I do not like the, you know, using the chemicals. If you guys have got any tips for me there, that would be great.
Well, unfortunately, the tansy is one of those that you can't just mow down. You have to pull it. So that's the bottom line. If you keep on mowing it down, it tends to just bloom at shorter and shorter levels. So
can you use one of those daisy root diggers, those stand-up things that pull those roots out? Will they work on tansy?
I haven't tried those. I don't know. Usually they're not that, I mean, in the realm of pulling weeds, they're one of the easier ones. So, and if you can get them when they're rosettes, that's the best part. So get them before they actually turn into a big stalk. So I use a tool. My main weeder is called the Digit, which is locally made. And it's just basically a piece of angle iron that, with a nice squishy handle that's fluorescent so I can find it.
Ah, John, I have to ask, are you standing out there in a chicken coop?
Oh, sorry, my mama that I'm like chicken herding over.
Oh, no, it's great.
To us.
We like to have a little sound effect. Thanks for your call. Run out of time, but I'm going to ask this really fast. Molly has a very small 5x2 foot flower bed, north facing, gets very little sunshine. Any suggestions for a mix of veggies, flowers, or vines that could thrive?
Oh, well, it's a small space for a mix. For flowers, I'd try some, they're all spring blooming. Epimedium would be good.
So plant them next year.
Greens. You could do some herbs like chives, parsley. They'll grow in that kind of space.
Anything from you?
No, that's a good combination. Yeah.
Well, Molly, start with that. And with that, we have to end this. And there's so many questions, and you can post them to the Green Days page on Facebook, and our gardening panel will look at those, or you can call us next week. Marty Winget writes about gardens and travel. You can find her at her website, martywinget.com, and then here on Tuesdays. Greg Rayburns, the Vashon Basin steward and co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk. Laura Matter, a practicing horticulturalist and coordinator of Seattle Tilth's Garden Hotline. You can go to the Tilth website and find out more about the Urban Farm and Chicken Tour or the Miller Horticultural site and find out.
MillerLibrary.org.
And find out about every other tour that you could possibly go on this weekend. Our show produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Join us tomorrow on weekdays starting at 9 o'clock.
Did you know that when you take your dog into a restaurant or bar in Seattle, you're violating the health code? Yeah, even though we see it all the time, dogs are technically not allowed in bars or restaurants in Seattle. So what do you think about that? Do you wish that rule was enforced more rigorously? Or do you like having dogs hanging around in public places like that? You can tell us right now by calling 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. 3663. Dogs in bars and restaurants, yes or no? That's today during the noon hour. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. It's going to get loud. A group of Seahawks fans is trying to break a world record. KUOW's Lisa Brooks explains in the news in a minute.
The woman was on the ground, and the bull was tossing her in the air and back on the ground.
And where were you?
I was right on the other side of the fence, but the fence was electric.
Why is it that certain people will risk their lives for a stranger?
I went ahead and just climbed through the fence.
While others...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.